The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everybody. Another episode of Life of Flow. Today, we are going to have a discussion with a good friend of mine, Stuart Bogger. Stuart's a lawyer. He's essentially heading probably a largest healthcare non-for-profit division in the U.S., and his focus is really on practice acquisition, practice mergers. And so he knows really a lot about contracting. And I think this is a time of year where there's probably a lot of you guys out there shopping for jobs, doing interviews. And let this be a word of caution. Do not sign any contract unless you review it with somebody that understands the lingo and that can give you some advice. This particular show delves into that, and I hope that you guys take the time to listen to it, learn from it the way that we did, because it is incredibly important to protect yourself as you are signing on the dotted line, okay?
Vamos.
Let's do it.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Well, Stuart, I was just really ecstatic that you parted a little bit of time away from your duties and from your family. I know you're a big family person, and this is already a Friday at 5-something p.m. Central Standard Time, so I know that somehow we're impinging a little bit on your personal time, but from us here at the Life of Flow podcast, we appreciate you. And we thank you for your time. It is not every day that we get to talk to a lawyer that's not charging us money.
Actually, he is charging you.
please don't bill us after the podcast.
Absolutely not.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. No, but you know, guys, Stuart, not sure if I've told you the whole story, but Lucas is a guy. It's not only the name of my son, but it's his name. And he trained and under the supervision of me and a few other guys at Baylor College of Medicine at some point in the past. And one of the things that I was always very verbal about is about a year before their graduation, I would start pushing them and pushing them and pushing them. Where are you going to go? Are you looking at jobs? How's the interview trail going? And more importantly, is there a place that you like? And have you gotten terms? Like, have you gotten some degree of contract? And it was not surprising that a lot of those times the answer was, oh, well, I don't know, or I don't have it yet, or, you know, I'll figure it out when the time comes, because I think everybody is so tired and so ready to move on by then, right? I remember you had already training exhaustion, right? I remember you were so pieced out, right? Like, I wouldn't say maybe a good 6 months, maybe 3 months before you were just like, I'm done, right? I've put years of my life into this. And then you see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that light comes with some dollar signs, rightfully so, right? I mean, you've put so much time into becoming a specialist or a subspecialty or a subspecialist. And then you start getting very excited about the money that you're going to come, you know, have, and the potential that you're going to have, and the wealth that you're going to. And a lot of times you just fail to recognize that nothing in life is free. Nothing comes without attachments. You don't get something for nothing. And in the process of doing that, whoever's going to be your boss or your patron or whoever's offering you this position is going to create an infrastructure that'll allow you to abide by a regulation or by certain rules. And And that's how you, you know, that's how you exchange goods, right? I'm offering you a job. You're doing this particular set of things that I need. And I'm going to give you a certain amount of money for that at a certain amount of pace. But it's not a handshake, right? I mean, it's a contract. And I think that people don't understand the seriousness of this contract and or take the time to dive into what contractual agreements mean. And they can become a big problem. I mean, they could be great, and, but they could be terrible too. And so I guess that's my long-winded explanation as to why I asked Stuart. Stuart's a person that I've known for a few years. I consider one of the, you know, most thoughtful, patient lawyers that I've come across in the healthcare matter. And also I consider you a friend at this point. And I think you have a vast experience in this, and you've helped me personally and some of the people that I've known, because I've continuously referred some people up to Stuart about, hey, look into your, like, take a minute or two and understand what you're about to sign. And I thought it was a really cool topic to, you know, like, to talk about this. So, you know, Stuart, maybe just at a super general overview on this is, you know, what makes you a subject matter expert in this? Not that I'm necessarily putting your acumen here on trial. I just want you to explain why your advice here matters. And then we can move into what would be, you know, maybe the first way of analyzing these contracts, and then we can kind of slowly dive into it. But your thoughts on this matter of physicians being potentially uneducated or unprepared when it comes to their potential contracts.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Miguel. Maybe just start with a brief introduction. You mentioned it in terms of, as we go through the conversations, what is my formative experience, and maybe what is the value that I bring to the topic? So just, you know, yes, I'm an attorney, and yes, I have a background in healthcare, M&A, and strategy and all those things. I currently lead strategy, compensation strategy and design for the largest nonprofit health system in the United States. So there's $2 billion under my purview. And with that comes responsibility to understanding how do we not only attract physicians and APPs, but how do we retain them? And when you think about attraction, you can throw a big number out, but the big number, if it comes with a lot of onerous terms and restrictions, you're not going to keep those individuals long term. And so it's my responsibility to ensure that we enact alignment strategies, financially sustainable strategies, but also retention strategies for the physicians that ultimately we would love to make career decisions within our organization. So that's who I am from a standpoint of formative job responsibilities and formative training. The other topic, Miguel, you mentioned is, why is it an important topic? I think maybe going back to the first introductory foray that you made into the conversation, where you said, Lucas, you've spent years and years and years, and you're getting ready to sign. Maybe it's $350,000, maybe it's $450,000. Those are big numbers. You've never made that money before. Sounds great. But the question is it market competitive? If you put in place an incentive, is that something you're ever going to achieve? What, in terms of call, is the call onerous or not? What does fair market value mean? All these things are considerations that when you go in, you can't just look at one without understanding the other. You have a 20-page contract, and for most of us, if we're not attorneys, that's not something that we deal with each and every day, and that can be overwhelming, and sometimes maybe you can gloss over restrictive covenants, you know, the importance of that. A valid restrictive covenant, even though the FTC and others have kind of moved away from that in the last week, and we have some ongoing new developments in that area. A valid restrictive covenant means I welcome you into my health system, I pay you a lot of money, and then I restrict your ability to leave. You've bought a house, you've done all these things to create a life, and then you say, this isn't the right fit, and now I have you stuck. So that's why the conversation is important, Miguel. You have to go in. As a health system, we want to attract and retain you. And to do that, we need to make sure that there's a meeting of the minds and there's a true ability for you to sign and feel as if you got the best deal for yourself that hits on a number of monetary, non-monetary considerations.
So what are the, Stuart, what are the kind of top things, you know, bullet points that you have to look when you have a contract? What are the top things that you look at? I imagine you have a couple of lines, you go into that 20-page contract, but you know where to go to really look at the important stuff. What's that important stuff?
So those important things what you really wanted to focus on is kind of two substantive themes. One is compensation terms. Compensation terms will either live in the agreement or live in supplemental exhibits, right?
Exhibit
find A. What those are. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is you're going to want to understand your restrictive terms. And so there's going to be probably about 4 or 5 paragraphs that talk about non-solicitation, non-compete, and a few other substantive clauses. You're going to want to understand those. And so each of those, if we want to go and delve into, we can delve into a little bit more so that as your listeners kind of look at their agreements, they start to note areas that are of concern. Yeah. Does that maybe work for you all?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, so I think maybe just laying a foundational level of knowledge is really important. So when you enter into an employment agreement, you're going to hear a lot of jargon. You're going to hear individuals throwing out terms, work RVUs, which you may or may not be familiar with, fair market value, FMV, commercial reasonableness. A lot of times, recall that these are large health systems, perhaps small health systems. They operate in a highly regulated environment. And normal business rules don't necessarily apply in healthcare. And I'll give you an example is when you would think about the ability of growing your business, it makes sense to look at individuals who send you business and create stronger attachments to them. Inducements, you know, for referrals, we want business coming our way. In healthcare, that's essentially illegal. And so we all can face intense scrutiny from not only the government, but also industry peers about what our practices are. And so when you enter into an agreement, you need to understand that there's going to be a lot of restrictions on what you can ask for and what you cannot ask for. And so the term fair market value is of critical consideration because it allows a health system to pay you in a certain way that they feel comfortable will not cause them to run afoul of anti-kickback and stark regulatory concerns. So that's just something I'd want to offer to your listeners as formative terms, fair market value, commercial reasonableness, and also this general expectation that what normal business interactions are don't necessarily carry forward in healthcare. So those are foundational. Any questions on those terms or just general information you would like to know?
Can you go into what does fair market value mean? I mean, it seems self-explanatory, but can you dive into it? How is that calculated? What does that mean specifically?
That's a great question. So fair market value, normally we would say it's what a willing buyer and a willing seller would exchange goods for. Typically, when we look at fair market value now in the context of a provider employment arrangement, we tend to look at compensation surveys. What are others doing? Because then it removes the independent, you know, you and I, what Lucas, what is your individual worth to me? And it says, what are the Lucases of the world, what are the vascular surgeons in this particular area worth? And they rely on these surveys for purposes of understanding what I can pay. And so that's what fair market value typically is in a very oversimplified way, is a referral to survey data or a referral to common practices within a given geographic area to understand what they should pay. Does that help?
And is there some way that I can, so say I'm going into, I'm coming out of fellowship and I want to, looking at jobs at Texas, Louisiana, and Florida, where can I get that information? When I go in, can I, to arm myself with that information to negotiate and to know if I'm offering, being offered a fair market value that's not correct for that area?
So you can individually subscribe to certain data sources. So MGMA is a data source. Sullivan and Cotter is a data source. And what they do is they submit queries to health systems and they say, what are you paying your providers? And we give that information back. They aggregate it, they blind it, and then we're able to rely on it. The challenge is micro markets. So if you look at Seattle versus Tacoma, or you look at Nebraska and certain subsets, what is a going rate is very different, 5 to 10 miles away from each other. The issue with survey data is that they're big cuts of data that they try to regionalize, but they try to regionalize by state. And so you may not be able to identify what your particular state or geographic area, what the going rate is. And so that's just one consideration. Another consideration is, even if you get your hands on this data, which you can, the challenge is understanding what is in the data. And by that, I mean, you look and you say, okay, well, I'm a vascular surgeon. At a vascular surgeon at the 25th, the 50th, the 75th percentile, here's what I should make. And that might be, and I'm just giving you general numbers. I could give you accurate numbers, but let's just say it's 450, 550, 700. Now at the 90th, it's $1 million. And you look and you say, okay, well, that's great. Well, the challenge is, do you have a basic understanding of what comprises that median? Who actually submitted for it? How many years of experience do they have? Are they taking call? Are they not taking call? It's reported W-2 income. And so you need to understand those data elements to be able to leverage and negotiate those for purposes of your negotiation.
Yeah. One of the things that I like to factor in when I have trainees talk to this is the cost of living is incredibly important to factor in, right? It's not the same if you're going to start, you know, if you're going to go to California as if you're going to go to Wichita, Kansas. But funny enough, there tends to be more competitiveness in trying to stay in the bigger cities that then drive the prices down. And so, I don't know. I'm very weary about this whole FMV because I'm not necessarily sure that it's the best way by which we can evaluate ourselves and what we're needing. I think you look for the city you want. I think you look for the group of people you want. You realize that the first 2 or 3 years are incredibly formative. And you need to think about other things, not just necessarily the price point. So what other value am I going to get from this particular program? Is this at least a decent salary? Am I going to be fine? Because I would always like advise you, don't chase the money, not on your first contract. It's the wrong thing to do. Don't chase the money. As long as it's fair, as long as you can get a good lifestyle, there's a lot more other important things in the contract that are not necessarily just a value, because you're looking at that place potentially to grow the first 2 years. You need a good senior backup. You need volume. You need a place that does what you like. You know, you like chronic limb-threatened ischemia. This is a center of excellence. Or you love aortic interventions. This is a center of excellence. That, for me, carries more weight than to hinge on the notion that you're going to get the best salary in the world and the fair market value has been, you know, that all is okay, but I think that you need to look into that. Now, what I would definitely be very, very, very zealous, very cautious, very, you know, is what are the terms of this contract? Mm-hmm. Is this a straight up salary? Is there a production, like, is it a productivity salary? Is this a salary support? What are you signing into? What does this mean? Because I've seen the whole, I mean, I've probably been the best example of what not to do. For example, when I went to Arizona, they gave me, I think it was something like $350. That was like my first salary off out the bat.
Yeah.
But it was a salary support in private practice. Okay. And what that means is that I signed at some point, and maybe somebody explained it in 1.2 seconds, and I probably never really understood. But what it meant is, we're going to give you whatever you need to get to this particular salary every 2 weeks. The moment you start producing money, we're going to pull out. Right? We'll pull back. Whatever that amount ends up being in the first 2 years, however much you drew out of that pot that we made sure that you were whole,
that
is now a loan.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to pay that by working at a fraction of whatever that contract was, you know, 3 years, 5 years. So let's say it was $300,000 divided by 72 months. Then every month I would get forgiven, whatever, $12.5K. And when I got the opportunity, quote, of a lifetime to come to Houston, and I decided to come, all of a sudden I realized that I owed those guys like $150,000. Because I didn't work out the contract.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's not just about, is the amount right? Is the amount fair? I would always say, where are you going? Why are you going? Are you happy and are you content? And then what are the contractual agreements of that? How long do they want you to stay there? Is it private practice? Is it academic practice? Is it a combination? Is it a federal government? Is it a VA? And what are the restricted covenants that come with it? So there's just a lot of other things that you have to start like going down. So Stuart, I guess you said number one is let's look at the numbers. Are you being compensated appropriately? Is it fair? I would say to that, I would add, what is the modality of your payment? How are you going to be paid? How are taxes going to be deducted? Like all these things I think are really important. And this goes to all of you guys, you know, a year or 6 months from being graduated, because you should be thinking about these things. And if you haven't, go get some help now, because this is really important. But then let's go at, you know, a level deeper. Or is there anything else there on that about, is it a support? Is it an actual salary? Is it, am I missing anything on that particular front?
You mentioned the components of compensation. I typically refer to them as domains of compensation, but that's nomenclature. What it really means is you understand the mechanics of how your compensation model works. If it's a base plus model, then typically you'll have a base salary that may or may not have an offset, Miguel, which you mentioned, but then you're going to have some opportunity compensation. And you look at that and, you know, presumably you need to understand if it's a productivity incentive, where's the threshold set? Is that reasonable for me in the first year, second year? Am I ever going to see this money? Because if they come to you and they say, hey, great, you have a $400,000 salary and you have this opportunity to make $80,000 more, and you look and you say, okay, well, quality metrics, it's a component. Are we able to track that? Do I understand what that is? And they say, you're going to have productivity. Is the threshold set reasonable? Is the dollar per work hour you, the amount that you make? Is that ever something going to be, is it going to be able to be realized? And that Miguel, is something that I would just want to highlight, is understanding how the model works and running through it and not just focusing on the base salary is going to be so critical for purposes of overall what you consider to be fair compensation, a livable wage, that you can't gloss over that and just look at one. You really need to know all.
How do you try to calculate in your mind what an acceptable dollar per RVU would be at a particular point in your career? Because I feel like that's a lot. There's a lot of like esoteric knowledge around that. And I've heard, you know, wildly different values for that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of guidance on this. And you know, one of the things that you'll see is that health systems frequently submit to the government pay practices to see if they're acceptable. And so the OIG, the Office of Inspector General, will come back and issue advisory opinions. Yes, that works. Yes, that doesn't work. A lot of times what will happen is you'll have a provider who has been out for 10, 15 years, developed, not only from his process standpoint, his team and support standpoint, a very highly productive profile. He's at the 90th percentile. And he'll come and he'll say, hey guys, I'm at the 90th percentile. I should be paid at the 90th percentile in terms of dollar per work RVU. And what the OIG and others have said is, we typically do not see that happen. As you move up the production profile curve, your imputed dollar per work RVU actually goes down. And so it's counterintuitive, especially in private practice, to say, well, wait a minute. I make more on my 500th work RVU than I made on my first. My first goes to cover practice expenses. My 500 should be profit. That's not how the surveys work. And so Lucas kind of dial it all the way back. What's fair from a dollar per work RVU basis is entirely dependent on the compensation model that it's plugged into. If you are being paid from dollar from work RVU number one, you need a higher dollar per work RVU to achieve market competitive rates. If you are being paid after hitting a certain threshold, then you have to understand, okay, well, what is and where is that threshold? And how much am I making per work RVU? And am I going to make that for 1,000 work RVUs, 2,000 work RVUs? And so you're absolutely right. There's a lot of nuances there. But the best thing for you to do as an entering provider is to have a basic understanding and ask the question, okay, you have a team of 1, 2, 5 vascular surgeons here. What is the expected ramp up? And can you provide me work RVUs for this cohort over their first 2 years here? You can take that and use that for purposes of starting to understand and starting to model out what your projected compensation would be. And then you can say, is this dollar per work RVU, does it get me to where I think I should be based on Indeed and other kind of solicitations where you can see what others could be making right out? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I think it's important to, when you're looking at these jobs, when you go on the trail of interviews, most of these facilities will want you to come in and talk to. I would not hesitate to ask, how many RVUs are you guys pulling in? Like, because you want to understand what, okay, 450 is a base, or 350 is the base for how many RVUs? I mean, there's going to be an expectation that you're going to have to work for it. And so you're going to have to try to identify what your goals should be. Now, in an academic model, they tend to be a little bit more, they protect you, they shield you from that a little bit more. And if you don't produce the RVUs that you're supposed to produce, then you'll potentially view the division as a group, potentially, I don't know, there's ways around it. But I think it's very important to understand what are you trying to get to? And then more importantly, what do you do to get to a next level? Because then that's the other thing that I think it's incredibly important, is knowing that these facilities, to Stuart's point, depending on your academic rank, they incentivize you financially to make more money with the same amount of RVUs. So the RVU for an assistant professor, the dollar per RVU for an assistant professor is different from the dollar RVU from an associate professor, which is a different RVU from a professor. Yeah. And so there's that reigns over the necessity for you to go through the ranks so that you can get, so you're essentially stuck in it. And so I always say, like, well, mind the fact that you don't need to overproduce, right? There's no sense in doing 30,000 RVUs.
Yeah.
When you're an assistant professor, because you're not necessarily going to get to that next level unless you actually put some papers out and do whatever it is that you need to do. And most of these places have different ways in which you can, you know, progress. And I would identify very well, how do you go through the ranks? Because that's the way. And then the other game that is played once you get in is you start taking responsibilities to offset your productivity goal. And so instead of you having to do the 15,000 RVUs or whatever, 10,000 or 7.5, you are now, let's say, you're the chief of limb interventions at some place. And for that, they're going to actually shave, you know, they're going to give you a 0.1 or a 0.2. Well, that means that they're shaving 20% of your goal RVU. And now with 80% of the work, you should be able to get the same salary. And that's when normally you probably work the same. And so now you get a little bit of a bonus. And so these things, for some reason, just nobody thinks about them until you're inside. Tell me, Lucas, you just, you know, you've been through this negotiation a couple of times. Have you really dug this deep into any of them?
No.
And it seems like it's something that you should do. Yes, Stuart, what were you going to say?
So I'm going to add a caveat is, Miguel, what you just mentioned is very pervasive in academic medical centers. If you go into other hospital systems, you could see in many ways that the movement into, let's just say, associate CMO positions or director positions or chief positions can have a negative impact on compensation. And it's a really interesting dynamic when you say clinical rates and how we value clinical rates versus administrative rates. In some specialties, you can have a pickup. If you look at primary care, if they're making $240,000, $250,000, the way that I value or could value administrative time actually can exceed what their implied effective hourly rate or dollar rate per work RVU is. If you go to neurosurgery, it's completely different. How can I value, if you're making $1 to $1.2 million a year, how can I value administrative time that functionally is the same as pediatric or primary care, some of the same core responsibilities? How do I value that at $500, $600, $700? And so it creates some challenges where academic medicine, based on how it's run with chiefs and chairs, there's just very, very unique considerations depending on the type of health system you're entering, depending on the role, the fractional FTE. Those are things, Miguel, you nailed it on the head when you said you need to understand that. You can't ignore it.
So let's move into some of the limitations in the contract.
Yeah.
All right. Non-competes, non-solicitations. Am I missing another one that's important there?
Yeah, I'd add a third, which is signing bonuses and clawing those items back.
Yeah.
Let's start with non-compete since the ruling came out from the FTC, I think, 2 days ago, saying that are they banned? What's like, does that apply to us?
There's a lot of limiting language. I would say that's going to be appealed. I would say right now we're seeing non-competes and the ability to freely move from one health system, one partnership to the other. It's being challenged. And so I think what we can do right now is we can acknowledge the fact that individual non-competes, while there is some indication that they are being thrown out, the limiting language about who it applies to, when it applies to, it's going to be challenges. It's probably going to be 2-3 years before we have solid, clear guidance about what's going to be permissible and non-permissible. And there's going to be precedent set where we can say this is the rule of law in this particular area, or this is the rule of law in the country.
So if I was asked, you know, asking for your advice, saying, hey, Stuart, I'm going to quit and set up shop 2 blocks away from my office, what would you say? Because of this ruling?
I would say, first, please let me see your contract. but I think the second thing I would say is you're likely going to have it challenged. And this is, please keep in mind that this is categorical advice. And so when you kind of take a step back, some health systems say the good of the community, the embedded resources, we're not going to challenge it because it's going to impact our reputation and it's going to impact in some way, maybe lead to patient harm. Not all health systems do that. You have very litigious health systems that will come after providers and say, we do not want you here. We have a vested interest in bringing someone else on, and I do not want you there. I would say that it would have to be a multifactorial analysis where you and I sat down and we said, law isn't clear. What does your contract say? And who are you working for?
I would say maybe even more important than somebody like you deciding that they're going to quit on a contract that's already executed and has that provision. I would say more importantly to those of you out there that are about to sign contracts, take it with a grain of salt. I don't think that you can go into it being like, oh, FTC ruled on it, we're good. I don't think that we're there yet. To Stuart's point, it'll take a few years of back and forth before we know where it's going to land. And understand that what I would do at this point, my advice is it's going to be really hard to not get one. But everything's up for negotiation. So whatever you're given, and usually it's a matter of time and distance, right? We don't want you to work anywhere close to a certain amount of geography. 5 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles from the place where you do the most, because sometimes there's multiple facilities. So usually the rule of thumb is wherever you practice 50% or more of the time. So if it's a big system and you go to different clinics, the epicenter is going to be where you spend most of your time. Now from there, 10, 20, 50, whatever, 100 miles for 12, 24 months, 36 months. I don't know. The usual is I've seen 10 to 15 miles for 12 months. That's what I tend to see. And
what's a really egregious bad term? And what do you think, Stuart, would be a really reasonable good term as far as distance and time?
So it depends on geography. If it's rural, you can see 50 to 75 miles being upheld. But if it's highly urban, Houston for particular, then you're going to have something that is likely about 10 miles. And those seem to be fairly standard. That's something that I would say is generally supportable as it's established now. What's egregious is where you see 20, 30 miles from everywhere you practice. There's not a materiality threshold. Miguel, you just mentioned the 50% trigger.
Correct.
Where they say, okay, well, if you've practiced anywhere within the last 2 years, which is an unreasonable term, as opposed to 50% during a 6-month time period before you terminate, that's where we're going to draw the bubble and line around. And those are ones that I think are overreaching in nature, where they try to establish a very fluid geographic area based on a site of service that maybe you've infrequently provided services at.
Are those enforceable?
Typically, they're going to be challenged, and in some cases, they're not necessarily. They're going to have a very hard case showing that there's legitimate business interest in precluding you from a site of service that you've only infrequently provided services at.
But it's, you know, more importantly than can they can they push you out is can they become a headache? And I think that that's, you know, it takes these corporations a couple of disgruntled lawyers to just literally make your life a living hell. And so I would always advocate that if you're in a situation, A, negotiate the shit out of everything. And if you get to a point where you're going to leave, then negotiate the shit out of everything. Meaning, don't just hope that they don't come after you. Have the conversation. Come to the table and negotiate a buyout. Because the same way you get into this contract, the same way you can get out of it, right? And you can offer a buyout to your non-compete. And actually,
you can do it on the front end.
You can exactly. I would say as you negotiate it, maybe you want to even negotiate that clause in. So, for example, you can say, listen, if I ever get to a point where I want to leave, what would that money amount be? And so you can enter the agreement already with an understanding that to break the agreement, that is going to be a certain amount of money. And you know
what,
that.
What a reasonable amount for that?
I think...
what's a range?
What I've seen, I mean, Stuart, correct me, but it could be something like 50% of your of a year's collection.
Yeah.
It can be. I typically, because professional collections can vary depending on the payer, the institution, the mix of non-payer to payer. We see that providers, to the extent that they extend, or I'm sorry, my apologies, health systems, to the extent that they allow for buyout provisions, they look at what did they actually pay you and try to recoup some portion of that. It's either a year's salary, half a year's salary. It's subject to negotiation, but I see more of a trend now, Miguel, focusing on what they actually paid versus what they actually collected.
Got it. Interesting. Non-solicitation. Right. Non-solicitation, which is another thing. And I would say, if you don't mind, dive into the difference between non-solicitation of employees and non-solicitation of patients.
Yeah, so when we think about non-solicitation of employees, just as it sounds, it's a general restriction on your ability to reach out to someone you worked with, an MA, you know, scrub tech, whoever it is, and ask them to come with you wherever you're going. Those are employees of the health system, and they do not want you to go to those employees and actively seek to move them over with you. Solicitation of payment or patient is somewhat different because there's a interest in continuity of care. And so we have to be really, really careful of the fact that you have certain rights and there's notification rights and everything else as you leave to ensure that if the patient wants to continue care, they can. But there are all there's restrictions on your ability to say, hey, you're whispering in the waiting room, hey, I'm going over here on Tuesday. Why don't you follow me? And so you have to be really careful of understanding your state-specific requirements to allow for continuity of care without impinging or violating a non-solicitation of a payment or a patient, which is very, very different. You can put out a general solicitation in a newspaper that says, I'm going over here, but you cannot go into a waiting room and let the patient know where you're going, when you're going, and give them a business card for your new place of service. And so while those differ depending on the state, the intent is the same. Continuity of care, continuity of the patient relationship is very, very important, but there are some restrictions that we have to be cognizant of by the state.
I think that what you need to know in that sense is that if you do get to a point where you leave, that... I think that depends on the different states, but I believe that most of them demand that there's a letter sent to every one of your patients. Essentially, and here's something that I think you have to fight for, and this is something that has been done to me personally, where essentially you leave, and I'm not going to go into details, but you leave And this letter should be a very clear letter of not necessarily why you're leaving, but where are you going to be? Okay. Why? Because if I am Mr. Smith and I've had a 5-year relationship with you and I love the way you care for me and I love to follow you, you're not allowed to tell me to follow you, but I'm allowed to go wherever the heck I want to go.
Yeah.
And the employer is obligated by law to provide information as to where I'm going to be if I ask. Okay. And so that's where most of these places, I believe, do fail to provide very appropriate guidance, because most patients will ask, you know, where they go. And that's where a lot of things fall through. Yeah. And so what they'll do very quickly, they'll send a letter, because it is their, you know, they're in the right to offer you an alternative. And so, hey, Dr. Ferrer left. We have Dimitrios that's still on staff and he's very amazing and we're going to move your patients over to Dimitrios. Would, you know, please call this number if you'd like us and we make sure that you're going to be seen by one of our specialists. But they're not telling you that Dr. Lucas Ferrer just went across the street, and if you want to follow with him, all you have to do is call that other number. And hypothetically speaking, or theoretically speaking, that's something that they should do. And so you have to kind of fight for that to happen. And
is that even like, is that a letter your lawyer sends to the hospital saying that they have to do it based on the law or what?
Correct. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that a lawyer could then interject and say, listen, there's a certain time frame in which you have to provide this notice. There's rules and regulations. There have to be noticeable announcements within the clinic spaces.
Mm.
The front desk has to have a picture and a name and a place where you're going. So there's all these things that they have to do by law to provide patients the capacity to take a voluntary decision to follow you. And that's where they don't do that a lot.
And because so, we probably don't push for it.
Exactly. Or because we're just ignorant. We don't even know that.
I didn't even know.
Yeah. Okay. And so some of these hospitals
are much better
at doing that. Some of them are really good. They abide by the law and they do it the right way. And some of them tend to be sneaky about it to try to, make patients not follow you. Stuart, you were about to say something.
I was just going to say, it really goes down to that central theme of abandonment. The patient relationship is so important for purposes, not only of continuity of care, just, you know, trust. And there's so many things there that you, holding a medical license, you can get in serious trouble to the extent that you abandon the patient, right? And so understanding those repercussions, and then Miguel, to your point, understanding the obligations of a current employer or former employer is essential, not necessarily for establishing a new patient relationship in your new place of practice, but really for ensuring that there's continuity of care and there's not a finding of abandonment. And that's really that central issue that you want to understand and want to understand your state-specific rules related to.
And do you think there's negotiation space in these clause? Can you negotiate the non-solicitation?
You can. I would say this, that to the extent that you have non-solicitation and you have non-compete clauses that vary tremendously, there's going to be questions as to why. And you can run the risk of a health system of having all of those thrown out.
Yeah.
You're discretionary for this one provider. Is that because there's a volume and value of referrals? He generates a lot of business. Why did he get a special deal and this other individual didn't?
Yeah.
And so while you can see perhaps smaller systems yielding to pressure, the bigger the system, the less latitude, the less flexibility they have on those core clauses.
As far as solicitation of employees, say you have...
That one's like, I feel out of all these things, it's kind of really hard to enforce.
Is it like
because have a, because yeah. your employees don't have non-competes?
Yeah, but if say you
like
have,
MAs or nurse practitioners usually
you have
don't
like a tech in the cath lab that you work with every day that you have a great relationship.
Yeah,
and mm-hmm. they say, oh, like, do you have an opportunity to go? You know, is that how enforceable is that? How likely is someone to go after you if they see that that really valuable member of the team went with you?
Yeah, those are ones that I would say you're not going to run afoul of a solicitation provision to the extent that you do a general advertisement. Hey, look, I'm listening for a scrub tech. That scrub tech happens to apply because he's followed you. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have an issue. Where you get into an issue is where you've sent this individual a text and it says, hey, I'm gonna bring you over, and here's what your new rate is, and I'm really looking forward to having you join the team. There's been no general notice that you were gonna have this. It's to that particular person. They can go and they can look at your phone and they can see, yes, you knew you weren't supposed to bring somebody over. You were still our employee, and here you are with a fact pattern where you brought this individual over. That's problematic. I would say that to the extent somebody wants to freely move and they followed where you're at, that's fine. It doesn't pose a risk to you.
Okay.
And the focus, Miguel, is not on the MA and the MP. It's on your solicitation. And you're absolutely right. They don't have a restriction. They can go and move. It's what would a likely employer who may be frustrated. You might be an oncologist. They recruited. They built a cancer center, and then you're choosing to leave, and maybe they don't have a replacement, or maybe they you're going to a competitor, and there could be a feeling that okay, well, I've invested in this programmatic development. This individual is leaving, and now he's taking all the oncology nurses and everything else with us. So it's just something to really be aware of. You have your compensation terms and you have your restrictive terms, and both of those are ones you really want to focus on.
Given kind of like a tangent here, if the FTC ruling is upheld and non-competes are thrown away, how do you think that will affect negotiations for all these terms? Especially for compensation. I guess the non, you know, the non-compete will go away, but for compensation and such.
Yeah, you're going to see a shifting. I think what you would ultimately see, and this is just Stuart Bacher talking based on something that he, I don't have a crystal ball. I think what you will see is more of a golden handcuff situation where individuals have a very large sign-on bonus with a 4 or 5 year amortization time period. And it's at a point where, Miguel, to your point, $150,000 is $150,000. And you're going to start seeing not necessarily a non-compete, but something that ties compensation to retention and maybe some other way in which you lock the talent in without having a formal non-compete. And you're going to see that. You're also going to see, I think, and this is something that we should be doing right now as health systems, is compensation is 50% of the equation. If you have a bad boss, you have bad coworkers, bad culture, you may say that you're leaving for compensation, but you're leaving because you don't enjoy where you're working. And all the other stress is too easy or too hard maybe to articulate. And you look and you say, okay, they don't pay me enough to do this. It's 50% of the equation. I think health systems have to do a much better job of really articulating, why do we engender the joy of practicing medicine here? Look at all the people you work with. You like working here. And so I think they're going to have to start doing a better job of not locking talent in based on non-competes, but keeping them based on the joy and engendering the practice of medicine. Productivity just in and of itself and saying, I'm going to put you on a pure production model and you're just going to work each and every day and that's what you're going to do. You didn't go to school just to crank out cases. You went to school for other reasons. And how do we recognize that? How do we start baking that into a compensation formula, into our culture, to make sure you stick around because you want to and not because you have to?
Yeah, that's funny enough, there's a very personal opinion on this. I was having a conversation not too long ago with somebody that I was trying to recruit. Because I think that we're, you know, here at Hope, at some point in the near future, we're going to have, you know, we're going to need an extra set of hands. And I started talking to this person. And they asked me, what's your non-compete? And I said, there's not a non-compete. I said, what? I said, yeah, there. Because here's the deal. If we start a negotiation where, as your boss, I'm trying to shackle your ass into my system, I think speaks terrible about what I think my capacity as a corporation, as an institution, as a boss is. I would say, listen, if I can't provide you with the tools to succeed, if you are unhappy in my system, then you should go and work somewhere else. And it makes me, I think it puts the pressure on me to retain, to your point, Stuart, because I want this to be the best job you've ever had. I want you to be, you know, like when we talk about the reps, right? Mm-hmm. What do they say when you talk about Gore? When you get to Gore, you never leave. It's the job of your dreams. They've got the best employee, you know, everything in this place. They are treated well. They're paid well. They're compensated appropriately. They have great bonus and incentives. They have lots of stuff for their families. Why would you leave? Nobody lives Gore. Same for this. Like, there should not be a non-compete, because if you provide appropriate place to work, you should. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just too much of a dreamer here, but that's how I see it. So to anybody out there, if you're looking for a job, when we post it, you will not have a non-compete with Hope, because our intention is to make you happy, to make you full, to make you content, to have a good work and life balance. That's what I would love to see contracts. To your question, where should these contracts care about the guy you're getting in? Right? Make sure that you give me a competitive salary, but also all this other stuff that should make me want to stay and be part of this institution and wear the jersey and feel proud about being part of, I don't know, Memorial Hermann or Mass General or UCLA. I don't know, you know, like convince me that I'm happy and show me the path to happiness and fulfillment.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, that comes to the point, like, are we seeing, like somebody told me once, you know, when you go to the C-suite and you look at the columns of assets and liabilities, doctors go on their liabilities, on their expenses. You know, the CAT scan goes under an asset. So the CAT scanner gets, you know, monthly maintenance to make sure it keeps working appropriately. Guess who doesn't get that?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, Stuart, you've been super kind to give us an hour of your late afternoon on a Friday. It was great. It was a great topic. I know a lot of the young people and even people in the middle of their careers thinking to change. Stuart, do you know, by the way, do you know the statistics on vascular surgeons that change jobs within the first year? You know that number? What would you give me a ballpark percentage? How many of vascular surgeons within the first couple of years of graduation and getting their job change jobs?
I would say it's probably upwards of 50%.
Yes, sir. It's in the 60%, 60 to 70%. Yeah. And it's not because of their damn compensation. So to all of you out there, look at all these things. Think about all these things. There's a lot of things to dissect. Choosing a job, it's not the job. It's the boss. It's the people you work with. It's the contracts, is all these things. So anyway, Stuart, you really, really, really nailed it on a lot of key points. I'm sure people are going to love this, maybe potentially even save it in their favorites, listen to it a couple of times, and seek guidance, guys. Not everybody's a lawyer. Sometimes the jargon is too much for us to understand. We're really good at blood vessels, but we're not necessarily great at reading contracts. So get yourself you know, some advice. Stuart, you want to close it up with a comment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that these overarching themes of saying that while compensation is important, it's not the only thing. And so you want to understand what you're signing your name to, but then you want to understand what is the practice environment. And if you can really go in with a feeling that you have asked the right questions. And sometimes questions are uncomfortable. And that's why sometimes you have attorneys, is to ask these questions. Maybe you don't want to ask, but you know are important. But if you can ask the questions and gather the intelligence, then you don't have to be a statistic. You don't have to be one of these individuals who come in, they're there for 2 years, and you might have been miserable for 2 years while you're looking, and then you leave. That's not the intent. Not the intent on a health system side, and certainly not the intent for any provider who's just coming out. So thank you for the time, Miguel. Thank you for the time, Lucas.
All right. Thanks, Stuart.
All right, brother. Have a good evening. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.